Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Mobile hunters, are you looking to make the move to saddle hunting this year? Or maybe you just want to add a few new pieces of gear or upgrade your current saddle gear. If that's the case, then head over to TetheredNation.com where they've got all mobile hunters covered. Whether you're new to saddle hunting or an old timer, Tethered is your one-stop saddle shop. From saddles to ropes, sticks, ascenders, whatever it is you need, they have you covered. I've personally been using their gear for the past three seasons. Now my base setup consists of the Phantom saddle and the Predator platform. And if you're wondering why I've chosen to use their gear above all else, here's the cliff notes. They're innovative and pushing the mobile hunting forward overall. They cut no corners and prioritize the safety and performance of their gear. They care about the community that they've created, and their gear allows me to hunt free. And above all else, I like to support good people doing good work. If you're interested in upping your mobile hunting game, then head to TetheredNation.com. This podcast is brought to you by Skull Brew Coffee Company. Skull Brew Coffee roasts premium single origin coffee, guaranteeing to deliver the freshest coffee directly to your doorstep. The kicker? They're 2% for conservation certified and donate 10% of their proceeds back to organizations who support the interests of our hunting community. So go to skullbrewcoffee.com and pick up one of their three killer roasts and fuel your hunt and fill more tags with Skull Brew Coffee. Welcome to the Truth from the Stand Deer Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Skull Brew Coffee Company. I'm your host, Clint Campbell, and you're listening to episode number 231. Today, I'm joined by the UP bow hunter, Todd Freeman, so stay tuned. What is up, everyone? Happy Wednesday to you. Hope you're doing well. Hope you are feeling fine. I actually just got back from a little scouting trip, so I'm actually a little late to the game on this. I usually try to get this stuff recorded, wrapped up over the weekend, but I actually am changing gigs, and so this is the in-between week, in between one gig and the next. And so I'm trying to take full advantage of it and get some stuff done out in the timber. So this past weekend, the reason why I'm kind of late to the game on this edit is just I was up in the mountains, took the trailer and headed up there to get some cameras out, and met up with my buddy Tom Runscavage, who he was on the podcast just I think one podcast ago, actually, if you want to go back and listen to that. So he was gracious enough, since he has some familiarity with the area that I was looking at and had been scouting and stuff like that. He was gracious enough to meet me up there. I was planning to go up this past weekend anyway. He actually texted me and just said, "Hey, I'm going to be up there on Sunday. If you want to meet up." And so, I left here. I had some stuff to do on Saturday with my daughter, some horseback riding. And so I left Sunday morning to meet him, made the couple hour drive up, took the trailer and met up with him, probably around, I don't know, noon or so on Sunday. Hot for this time of year, you know, the 80s, you know, 86, whatever it was. So it wasn't a pleasant scout, so to speak. would have been a little nicer with some cooler temperatures, but we put in some miles, checked out some more areas that I had kind of marked on the map, and he had some interest to check out too. So we did that together, hung some cameras, and then hung out that night. We were going to record, I was going to do the upfront of this and maybe record a podcast, but we decided to instead just enjoy the nice weather and sit out and have a couple pops and just talk, and just cut up.
and talk deer hunting together. So no formal podcast from that session. But a good time nonetheless. So he had to split after that. And so I spent the night there and got up on Monday morning, and there was an area that I wanted to scout. He had hit the, I guess it was the eastern side of this particular piece of this side of the mountain. And I had interest in kind of in the western side of it. And so I figured I would kind of hike my way up through that and see what I could see. And so ended up setting up a couple cameras up in that general area. And actually, one of the cameras that I set up, I had hung some cells where I had cell service. There's not much cell service in that general area, but I did find a pocket or two that I was able to set up a cell camera, and I actually started getting deer on camera as early as last night / this morning. So, you know, Monday night into Tuesday morning. So pretty excited about that, because, you know, these new places, like I've said in the past, this place doesn't have a ton of sign necessarily. So you're really looking for, you know, very, like, I guess, minimal sign, and hoping that, at least for me, because I'm not familiar with the area, and hoping that you're setting your camera in the right spot and that you're going to pick something up. And so this particular area that I was getting some action on the camera, it was actually a set of scrapes that I'd found. And they were, you know, when I went back this past weekend, the one scrape was still open. It was clearly had been tended, you know, recently. And so it gave me some hope that, you know, deer were still kind of moving through there. That, and it was one of the only areas that I found a trail that was pretty significant, where they clearly were using this little crossing. And then that's where the scrape was at. And so I felt pretty good about setting up a cell camera there. So did that, and then ended up busting my way home. And I'm going to make quick work of this up front, because I am actually going to get out today yet again and put up some cameras. I'm trying to get all my camera work done for the most part this week, at least in some of the harder to reach areas where I have some time that I might need to, one place in particular, I need to map out access. And so that's actually what I'm going to do today. Since I have a little bit of cool weather today, I think the high is only supposed to be in the mid 70s. So I figured today would be a good day to go out, do that, map out my entry and exit, and hang a camera in that particular area. So with that, we're going to go ahead and get ready to jump into today's podcast. But before we do that, a quick note from our buddies over at Exodus Outdoor Gear. You know, I'd mentioned it last week in the podcast. They were teasing something that was coming up, but now I can actually let the cat out of the bag. And this month actually marks their 6th anniversary of being in business. As you guys know, I've been working with them for years. And in order to celebrate, they're sharing some great savings with everyone who listens to this podcast to help everyone get ready for Velvet Fest, which is upcoming here in the very near future. So starting right now until June 11th, use the code YEAR6 to save 20% on Exodus Render, which is their cell camera, the SP18, which is the solar panel for any of their cameras, and the Render SP18 bundle. So that's a cell camera and the solar panel together. So if you're not familiar with all the stuff, all the products that Exodus has, the Render is their cell camera, like I just mentioned, runs off of Verizon 4G LTE and has some of the fastest transmission times in the entire industry. And on top of that, it's about as user-friendly as you could possibly get. I set up 3 cameras last night, actually, and probably it was under 10 minutes, and I had all 3 cameras activated and working. I highly suggest, as I'd mentioned, using their 12-volt solar panels with any of the Exodus cameras. The SP18 Render bundle is part of the anniversary sale, and that duo allows you to set the camera and forget it. I literally put out cell cameras last year in a particular area at the beginning of June and was still getting pictures this morning, have never touched it, never changed batteries, never did anything except set it and forget it, and over a year later, it's still rocking. Over the last 6 years, Exodus has consistently shown that they build quality trail cameras that flat out work. And of course, the best trail camera warranty, period. Every single camera is backed by the 5-year warranty and even comes with a theft and damage coverage. That's right, 5 years, literally half a decade, and you'll be covered with the Exodus 5-year warranty. But more than likely, you won't need it because their cameras are already built to last. So be sure to take advantage of the savings opportunity and use the code YEAR6, that's YEAR, the number 6, and you'll save 20% at checkout when you head to ExodusOutdoorGear.com. This offer only lasts while supplies last, which usually isn't too long when you do these types of deals. So head over to their website, ExodusOutdoorGear.com, and be sure to give my buddies over there some support. So now with the housekeeping out of the way, we'll go ahead and get ready to jump into today's podcast. I have the UP Bowhunter on. If you're not following him on Instagram, give him a follow at UP Bowhunter. But Todd Freeman is a good buddy of our mutual friend, Greg Litzinger. And that's kind of how I was introduced to the UP Bowhunter. And this session is really part one of a two-part series that we'll do together, or a two-part, you know, episode that we'll do together. just because it was super long. I mean, we talked for almost 2 hours, and we spanned everything from shed dogs to growing up in the UP to obviously, you know, bow hunting in New Jersey where he currently lives and traveling out of state and everything in between. So really cool session. And today's session, you know, is part one, number one. And what we really focus on is a little bit of, you know, Todd's background growing up in the UP. Actually, we jump into a little bit of trapping and how that kind of influenced and, you know, his brother, who was a big trapper growing up, influenced his hunting kind of trajectory and some of the takeaways from that. And then, of course, we then transition into deer hunting and what he's into now. So with that, we'll go ahead and get jumped into today's podcast. And as always, I want to thank you all for listening. All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of the Truth from the Stand Deer Hunting Podcast. And today I have a fella on who admittedly has taken me way too long to have on. We have a very good mutual friend in the bow hunting fiend, and this is a fella he spent some time with. And Greg has been telling me, he's like, man, he's like, you've got to have UP bow hunter on. You've got to have UP bow hunter on. And I've been meaning to, and I was just saying before we started recording, it's like, there's like 100 million people you want to try to have on in 52 weeks and a year to make it happen. So today I have on none other than Mr. Todd Freeman, the UP bow hunter. How's it going, man?
It's going good, Clint. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man, you bet. So I know we might have a little interruption. We'll go ahead and set that story up. Now we have some family members that might be coming home and a dog that might be seeing his mama. So we might have a little canine disturbance, right?
Yeah. I'll try to make it as quick as possible as soon as she comes in the door, though.
Oh man, it's no worries. I've got one too, and he's like my best friend, my shadow essentially. But he is certified. Yeah. He's certifiably crazy. Like,
yep.
I've told
you got this, a lab too, right?
Yeah, I've got a lab too, and it's so I had a lab when I was growing up, when I was a kid, and hadn't had one since. And I've always had, like, you know, I had a lab growing up, I had a shepherd growing up. And then my dad got into, like, I had a chow chow growing up. I had golden retrievers. That was really what stuck with my dad. And my stepmom was like having golden retrievers and stuff, and awesome dogs. And then when I moved away, I ended up having, you know, Rottweilers is what I had. And English Mastiffs. Those were the breeds I usually had. And so my daughter wanted a dog, and like just a good family dog, you know, and I was like, oh, cool. I was like, a lab, you know, something I can take out in the woods with me that'll be, you know, gained enough energy to want to go scout and stuff like that. And, I just did not realize like their personality, like how attached to their people they are.
And they are.
Yeah.
They're a really, really tight dog. This is, me and my wife have been married 29 years, and, this is our third lab, second chocolate male.
Mm-hmm.
He's 18 months old. His name's Archie Bunker. he's had a shed antler in his mouth since the day that we picked him from the litter. I left one with the breeder for him. I think they were all I never seen it again. They were probably all chewing on it, nibbling on it, and whatnot. But and then he had one the day that we picked him up. He carried one he was 8 weeks old or whatever, and he carried one out to the car with him. And my son. So, yeah, he's been around antlers his whole life.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, it's so we rescued this one that we have. Okay. He was in a bad situation, so we took him from those folks. And he's a great dog. I just wasn't ready for how tight they are to their people, because I had, you know, Rottweilers and mm-hmm. you know, Mastiffs, and they're really kind of lazy dogs. And like, if you want to engage and play with them, like, they're happy to do it. But if you want to go to like a different room and do something else, like, they're happy just to hold the floor down wherever they're at. You know what I mean? It's like, they don't need to be right on top of you. And I kind of got used to that, you know? And so it drove me crazy for like the first year, where I'm like, I would turn around and he's like standing right there looking at me like, hey, what are we doing, man? What are we doing? Where are we going?
You know? Exactly.
I'm just like, oh,
yeah, there's no break. There's no break from being the owner of a Labrador. That's for sure.
Yeah. And so I've learned to embrace it, you know, and how I did that was I just started taking him everywhere with me. You know, it's like, I go scout, he goes with me. I go camp, you know, he goes with me. You know, it's just like, if I'm going somewhere that there can be a dog with me, he goes, you know. And, and since then, like, you know, now we're like best buds. Like, I just couldn't imagine not having him. And so now I'm trying to teach him how to find sheds. And he's learning, you know. I'm trying to teach an old dog new tricks. That's what I'm trying to do. So we'll see. He's does okay in the yard.
Yeah. But it's in there. You just got to figure out how to get it out of the plant.
Yeah.
He trust me, he can find shit.
Yeah.
He just got to figure out how to get him to do it. That's it.
And he'll find him in the yard pretty good. You know, it was funny because, like, I'd play fetch with him. Like, I mean, he's a smart dog. Labs are smart, you know. So, I used to train dogs, you know, whenever I was in my early 20s, obedience training and stuff. I worked for a breeder. And so, like, I can get a dog to work for me, not in the sense of, like, hunting or whatever, but I can get it to be obedient and do what I needed to do, and I can train him off leash and all those things, right? And so getting mm-hmm. him to, like, fetch or, like, get the paper, it's like I trained him to get the paper in, like, 3 minutes. And, like, every Sunday morning I let him out, he goes, grabs the paper, brings it back, you know? And so then I just started thinking, I bet I could get him to find sheds, you know? But the thing was, it was like anytime you'd play fetch with him or anything, he never wanted to use his nose. He just always wanted to look. You know, like he would run right by like a ball you would throw. If he didn't see it, mm-hmm. he'd run right by it. He would never use his nose. And so it was just kind of cool whenever I started using a shed with him, you know, and kind of playing with him and playing fetch and then hiding it from him, like watching him, like truly watching him work. Cause I never saw him do that before and like watch him work the yard. And like, he'll start kind of running, work in circles around the yard to try to pick up a scent and stuff like that. And it was just really cool to watch. And like, and now he's finding them when I hide them, when I'm planting them, you know, that's he just good does. Yeah. He's doing really well. I'm going to try to have my buddy Tony Peterson on. Cause he's, you know, obviously really good with dogs. And I want to talk to him about it a little bit because I need to figure out what I need to do in the field with him a little bit more, because I had him out in the woods here like a week or so ago. We were doing some scouting and, you know, I took a shed with me, that way he would find one, you know, like he wins mm-hmm. every time we go out. And we were kind of scouting and we were close to this bed that Greg and I scouted this area. And we found this bed. And so I was like, well, if there's going to be a shed around here, it might be around here somewhere. And so I just said, hey, find the sheds. And he started kind of looking, but then he got kind of confused because he's like, hey, man, we ain't in the backyard. You know, he's like, I'm not sure what I'm doing, you know? And so he got a little confused, I think. And then I planted one for him and he found it. And then we called it a day, but I need to figure out how to transition him from the yard to the woods is my next step.
So when Archie was a pup, I don't want to hang on this too long, but when Archie was a pup, when he was real little, you know, 8, 9, 10 weeks old in 4 months and whatnot, what I would do is if I would throw one out there or throw a plant and he lost track of it, or I throw it and it started training in taller grass, mm-hmm. I would always know where it was at. And if he couldn't figure it out, what I would do is I would never bring him to the shed. But what I would always do is try to figure out which way the wind was blowing and take him in 10 yards downwind of it. You know what I mean? Yep. So he would start to learn that you have to get down, you know what I mean? Use your nose. And now it's just when he, I'm not saying that he's a good shed dog yet. You know, he's, like I said, he's 18 months old. This winter was his first winter and he found a few.
Right.
But you can see when he is on, what you're on a shed, or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because he just, his whole body just, you know, he's like a, well, that's what he's doing, what a retriever's supposed to do. You know what I mean? He knows it's here, he just doesn't know where it's at. His whole body just changes demeanor, you know?
Yeah. And I've watched that with Rocky too, where it's like, he'll get close. Yeah. I've done that too, where it's like, I've walked him downwind to try to get him to get close so he could smell it. And when, as soon as he does, man, it's like, mm-hmm. he'll get tight to the ground, you know, he stiffens up, you know what I mean? A little bit. And, you know, it just, he'll start working a little like perimeter around it, trying to figure out where it's at. And then I can watch, it makes me think of deer, because, and this will be a trend, you know, we can transition into deer hunting here in a second, but you know, deer smell almost at the molecular level. Right. And so I could watch mm-hmm. him go by it and he could tell he was getting just a little too far away, that the scent profile was getting weaker, and he would just turn right around. You know what I mean? Like he knew he was like right on it, and like, oh, two steps this way, it's a little weaker, you know, and he would just start to zero in, and then he would eventually find it. And it's just super cool to watch him work. And so I'm hoping he really takes to it, because, you know, it's just adding that to the woods, like when you're scouting, would just be super cool for me, because I've never had a shed dog, you know, and that would just be, you know, not to sound all corny, but totally take like he and I's relationship to the next level, you know, if he's able to do that. I mean, he's a great dog as it is, a great family dog, but. And I love spending mm-hmm. time in the woods with him, but if he can do that at the same time, then it's just like, you know, it's just different level, I guess.
Yeah. It's just good to, you know, to have a walking partner, man. Our last lab died probably 10 years ago or something like mm-hmm. that now. We went about 7 years, 8 years, something like that without having a walking partner. And it sucks. You know what I mean? It doesn't suck. I mean, you put a lot of sheds and stuff like that, but it's always good to have your dog with you, man. It really is.
Yeah, I find myself I'm willing to stay out and scout longer when he's with me. You know what I mean? Just because I got a buddy there that's with me. Now, he does still want to be on top of me in the woods, which drives me a little crazy. And when he gets tired, he walks behind me and lets me blaze the trail through the brush. You know what I mean? It's like when he's not tired, he's all over the place. As soon as he gets tired, he's like, hey, I'm just going to walk right behind you. You know, so, but, which means he's a smart dog. He's not stupid. Like, he knows what's up. He's like, I'll let the human blaze the trail here. I'm going to just go ahead and take her easy. But anyway, we're going to transition back to what we intended to talk about here, which is, you know, and what we always talk about on this podcast, which is some form of deer hunting. But, Todd, I appreciate you coming on, man. But before we jump into things specifically, I always kind of like to break the ice to a degree and just have people kind of share where they're, you know, where they're from, what they do for a living, so people kind of get a sense of a little bit about who you are.
Boat Trader, America's largest boating marketplace, offering easy financing and over 100,000 boat listings to choose from. Sell, find, and finance new or used boats on America's largest boating marketplace. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
All right, so my name's Todd Freeman. I'm the UP bow hunter on Instagram and the old forum, all the old forums that used to be around, the Hunting Beast, the Blood Brothers, and Archery Talk. There's all kinds of old ones. I'm showing my age a little bit here.
Right.
But most of the time, whenever I can grab the handle UP bow hunter, I've always been a UP bow hunter. And the UP bow hunter stands for Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And, you know, that's where I grew up. First 18 years of my life, I grew up there, you know, born and raised, just a poor country kid south of Marquette in the Upper Peninsula on the Lake Superior shore, fishing for everything you can think of and hunting and just doing everything you possibly could do outside. Grew up, I was fortunate enough, I was blessed enough to grow up with just a big, huge chunk of woods that you could walk for miles.
Right.
And tree forts and all that kind of good stuff. Out in the woods and, you know, shooting squirrels with your BB gun and
Stuff
the kids can't do nowadays. But, you know, back in those days, you know, your mom would kick you out at 8 o'clock in the morning in the summertime.
That's right.
She didn't have to kick me out. I was already at the creek back there fishing for brook trout and stuff. So,
right.
So grew up there, went in the Navy when I was 18. My first ship was in the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. It was getting overhauled at the time, and I was there for about a year and ran into my wife, Marcy. She's a South Jersey girl. Through some mutual friends and whatnot, we met and started dating, and, man, it was probably less than a year later we got married out in California, in San Diego, California.
Nice.
Bounced around. We came back here for a couple of years in South Jersey. So I bow hunted a lot in South Jersey back in those days. You know, you couldn't bait.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a baiting state in Michigan. So I learned how to deer hunt when I was 20, 21 years old when we started hunting here. Anyway, bounced all over the place with her when I was in the Navy. And then we decided when I got out to move back here to where she's from, because I loved her family and whatnot, and been living in South Jersey ever since. We've been married 29 years. I said that earlier. I work right now. I've been in the maintenance most of my life. Right now, I'm currently working for a water treatment company. I'm a sales and service rep for them. And nice. That's it.
Nice. So with that, what's your, I guess, shifts like? Like, do you get a fair amount of time to hunt? Like, I've had a couple guys on that have made me envious that work in the health care spaces, like, you know, RNs or physician's assistants and stuff like that, that like work, you know, 3 12-hour shifts and have 3 or 4 days off, or work 7 10s and have, you know, the 7 days off. So they're off every other week. What's your schedule look like?
Yeah, my schedule is basically 8 to 3, 8 to 5, somewhere in there, depending on what the workload looks for, like, for the day.
Right. Growing up in the UP, did you come from a hunting family? Was that just something that it was inevitable that you were going to do, or was it just like proximity close to like a wilderness area that you just naturally fell into it?
Well, to be completely honest with you, I think there was 250 people in my class, and I think there was probably three men right. that didn't hunt. You know what I mean?
So, right, right.
You know what I mean? And they all live in New York City now, or San Francisco, or something. I don't know exactly where. But,
right.
But you know what I mean? So they just weren't. You know, they just weren't. It wasn't in their DNA.
Right. It's like it's in that area. It's in your DNA. Right. In that area, it's culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, school shut down for a week. You didn't have to. You basically, school did not shut down. I mean, there would be classes, but you didn't even have to have a note.
Right.
For the week. So it's a little bit different than most of the people that I know from PA. Yeah. School actually shut down. Our schools didn't shut down, but you didn't even need a note from your parents.
Right.
To not be there that week. You know what I mean? Because everybody knew you're out of your camp. So.
Yeah.
The culture there is a lot like Pennsylvania in the fact that most people have a home, and then especially in the northern tier of Pennsylvania, and they'll have a camp 30 or 40 miles away in the wilderness, and that's exactly the way it is in the Upper Peninsula.
Right.
In those days, when I was growing up in the late 70s and the early 90s or early 80s, we had. Most people aren't going to believe this now, but we had Wisconsin and Illinois tags. I mean, the majority of the hunters were from Wisconsin and Illinois. They would come up to the Upper Peninsula to hunt. They didn't have deer back then. They had very few deer. Their herd was starting to expand. And then there was a lot of, agriculture change in the 60s and 70s that started to make it so the deer population would pick up down the farmlands. But the farms back in those days were not good hunting. It wasn't good. You know what I mean? So they would come up for the culture of being in the big woods and being part of a deer camp.
Right.
In those days. And they bought a lot of our camps. I mean, they're all sold back to Youpers now, but yeah.
Yeah. Youpers. And that's an interesting word, because I'd never heard that before. You texted me the other day when we were texting back and forth. You're like, I think it might be the first Youper on the podcast. And I'm like, Youper? I'm like, I don't even know what that is. So explain what a Youper is for people out there that are listening that might not know.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of people that are from the UP that will know the term, and other people in the surrounding areas, the Michigan people all know it. But so the Upper Peninsula, or the UP, is a 1/4 the landmass. It's the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's we got Lake Superior to our north and Lake Michigan and Lake Huron to our south, and Canada to our east, Wisconsin to our west. So there's two peninsulas of Michigan. You hear, if you ever heard anybody talk about the Thumb or the Mitten or anything like that they're talking about the Lower Peninsula. And if you ever hear them talk about, if a person from Michigan says, I went to Northern Michigan, they're not talking about they went all the way up. They're talking about they went to the top of the Mitten, or the top of the Lower Peninsula.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Before they get to the bridge. We call people from the Lower Peninsula trolls, because they live below the bridge that separates
the two peninsulas. That's funny.
So we call them trolls. It was always a joke. You know, they were flatland trolls down there.
Right.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's funny, man.
Yeah.
So how did, I grew up in the country. I grew up in a rural area, so I can kind of, I can jive with what you're talking about as far as like the culture and stuff like that. Because, we had, the first day of deer season off first day of buck season and first day of doe season every year. It was a day off from school, both days. Mm-hmm. I graduated with like a class of, I think there was 93. In my class.
Okay.
So super, super small, right? Super, super rural, where it was same thing as you mentioned. It was like, I don't even know. I can think of maybe one person in our class, like, kid, guy that didn't hunt growing up, what I mean? I can think, I can literally probably only think of one that I could name. And it was just one of those things where it was a rite of passage. And I know for me, even though I wasn't really bow hunting then necessarily, because I didn't start bow hunting until I got, I was probably 30 when I first picked up a bow. I mean, I'd always hunted, but, I didn't pick up a bow because my dad, I've told this story before, but my dad never really did a lot of bow hunting. He would go out and he would hunt with a recurve in the fall, whenever there would be a lot of wind or rain, because he preferred to stalk. I never was in an elevated tree setup until I was 30. You know, we always hunted from the ground. Everything we ever did was either hunting from the ground or still hunting. That was how I learned how to hunt. And so it's like, for me, it was, you know, not until I got a little older, and like, it certainly shaped, you know, how I, you know, it shaped me as a hunter. There's certain things that I did really poorly because of that, you know, and had to like unlearn some bad habits. You know, but there were certain things that, you know, were really helpful. And one of them was patience, right? Cause you know, it was a hard state to hunt. And this was obviously before antler restrictions and stuff like that, where you didn't see a lot of bucks, you know? And so you had to be willing to kind of grind it out if you were going to see anything, just based on, you know, the area that I lived in and the area that I hunted. So I'm curious for you, man, you know, and then I know maybe you didn't get into bow hunting like a little bit later, or really get into hunting whenever you maybe were like in the Jersey area, but you know, growing up being in the woods and in like a wilderness area like that, how did that, looking back on it now, how did that, or how do you think that shaped you as a hunter early?
Well, the thing about it that I think a lot of your listeners are going to have a hard time maybe relating to, and maybe they won't, but where I grew up, like there's people to this day up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan that live off the land. There's guys that trap and do what they have to do living in the woods to survive.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I was lucky enough in my lifetime to be around a lot of men that were like that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not necessarily that they were hermits or whatever, but they were men that didn't have a normal 40-hour job.
Right.
That, you know what I mean? Where they went and clocked in, they went and lived off the land. They did what they had to do off, you know, living off the land to survive.
And whether it was selling fur or catching fish or whatever it was.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. So I was fortunate enough to be around people like that and learn a lot of things. Now, you know, like trapping never really clicked with me. My brother is a big time trapper. He's a shitty bow hunter. He's a good shot. He knows what he's got to do, but he doesn't have any patience. He can't sit there long. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
He would be a killer because he can put a mink foot in a trap.
Right.
But yeah, and he can read deer sign. I learned more off of him about deer sign when we were a girl. And he's 3 years younger than me.
Right.
You know what I mean? I learned more off of him about deer sign than he ever will ever know how much I learned off of him.
Right.
But I would take the information and I would go out in the woods and I'd sit there.
Right.
You know what I mean? Until I killed something. He has a hard time sitting and you know, that's one of the reasons why he needs to stick to walleye and trap.
Right.
Here's this, he's gonna laugh. But,
so,
but he, yeah.
So these older, I'm just imagining in my head, and they may not be older, but I'm thinking just like when I think of, you know, guys like that are living, I'm thinking of like some old timers and stuff like that. But I mean, it's clear that there are still people that are doing that. So they're not old timers necessarily. Yeah, but
Clint, when I say that, I don't mean like, there's guys that are out in the woods 24/7, but there's guys that are trappers. They shoot coyotes in the wintertime. They do taxidermy. They do, you know what I mean? The different things that you can live off the land. And those trappers, those guys have more knowledge than we'll ever have.
Oh my,
on how to kill critters.
Yeah.
They really do. If a man wants to get good at hunting, he needs to really learn how to trap. And so, I know other people have said this, but it's the God's honest truth.
Right. So
it really is.
That's a perfect kind of segue, because that's what I wanted to ask you was like, what is it in, you know, those are super formative years, right? So even if like you had mentioned, like you really didn't even, like you said, I didn't really learn how to hunt, you know, quote unquote, right, until I was in my 20s. Right. And like, so like, I think I understand what you're getting at, where it's prior to that, it's like, it's playing around, figuring stuff out, having fun, right? And it's like you're kind of floating around like a feather in the wind and not quite sure where you're going to land, right? But that's also where you do a lot of like experimentation and learning and figuring out. So I'm just curious, you know, growing up in that area around people, because I didn't have that necessarily. Like I never knew anybody that trapped. And I always wished that I would have grown up around someone like that. I wish I had the patience to learn more about it, 'cause I just truthfully don't, you know, it's just not one of those things that I have, that I'm patient enough to kind of, to learn and understand. And I should be more patient with it, but Right. What are some things from like some guys that were around there that you grew up that were trappers, or whether it was your brother, or even though he was younger or whatever it was, like what were some of those lessons that you took from that, that later in life you were like, oh man, this is how this really gets applied?
Well, I think for one, like scent, you know, scent, and just how critters use scent. I think, you know, really just being in the woods. For one, you know, those guys are all, they try to always be in the woods. I mean, they're happy when they're in the woods, you know what I mean? And the one thing that you learn about if you're in this bull hunting game long enough, I mean, especially when you're young and you're learning, being in the woods is where you learn.
Yeah. There's no substitute.
You can take and listen, you can listen to people tell you things and this and that, but when you get in the woods and you actually go out and do it, those are the things that are going to really be pounded in your head. Now, there's going to be some things that people tell you along the way that tell you, you know, yeah, the deer do this and deer do that. But you, and you can believe them, especially if they're people that you trust and, you know, that you feel confident in what they're saying. But when you actually go out in the woods and see it, or you see something like that and you say, oh, that deer is doing what that guy told me, or whatnot, you know, trappers are a little bit different than hunters. I mean, one thing about trappers is they, for the most part, they have long, long lines and they have to do a 24-hour check or whatnot. So they're trying to be efficient when they're in the woods, you know, and they're bouncing from place to place to place. They're looking for not only critters, but they're looking for other trappers to see if other trappers are in the area.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, connectivity between trapping and hunting. It's the same kind of things that you have to look for when you're scouting a piece for hunting, you know what I mean? For bow hunting as well. You know what I mean? How are other trappers utilizing this? I think trappers, like I said, they have to be a little more efficient because they might have 100 traps they have to check every day.
Right.
You know what I mean? So they're not going to, unless they have something, they're not going to have one specific trap that's 2 miles back.
Right.
That's just a complete waste of time for one critter.
Right.
Every 24 hours. You know what I mean? They have to have things set up and they're boom, 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 boom. One thing you learn about them is they're really reliant on their equipment. They, and bull hunters can take that as well. You know, and putting your pack and your equipment together to be efficient. You're in the woods and you're doing things quick and fast. Trappers, they may look like slobs. They may look like hairy old gray haired men that got big old beards and they're dirty because they got muskrat grease on them and everything else. But those guys are efficient. When they pull up to a culvert or whatever, it is boom, bang, boom. And you know what I mean? They're back in their truck. You know what I mean? They open their tailgate, they're grabbing this, they grab that, boom, they go down there, smack a critter on the head, reset the trap, and they're up there, throw the critter in the back of the truck, and boom, they're gone.
Right.
You know what I mean? Let's move.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, I think the one thing that you'd mentioned, which is the big takeaway is like, you know, trappers, because they're kind of working these long lines and stuff like that, they just spend a significant amount of time in the woods. And what you kind of mentioned was learn by doing, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, there's no substitute for being in the timber. And I remember I was talking, did a podcast with Todd Mead. And one of the things that he said, and like, I wrote it down whenever he said it, was that, you know, you become a better deer hunter by being around deer, right? And it's just like what you were mentioning, which is, why is that deer doing that? You're watching him, like, oh, he's doing this, right? And for me, the big kind of aha moment was, you know, you hear people say it all the time. Like, I don't know how many episodes of this podcast I've done at this point, but I don't know how many times you talk to like really good bow hunters. And the one thing that they will tell you that's critical in getting a mature deer, you know, in range to take a shot is you got to give him the wind. Got to. Right. Like you might get lucky not doing that once in a while, but man, if you want to do it consistently, like you got to be able to give that deer the wind. And it's so counterintuitive to do that. Right. And I remember for me, it's like, I was always really nervous to do it because I'm like, I'm going to get busted. Like, you know what I mean? I'm like, there's just no way I'm going to be able to. And then I remember the first time I did it kind of correctly, you know, where it worked. And then at that moment it was like, I saw it. I observed it. I kind of looked at what my setup was and I was like, okay, I get it now. Like, I understand. Like, I understand like how I need to do this. Like, and it's not going to work 100% of the time. There are going to be times where I'm going to get busted, But if I want to have that type of encounter that I just had, this is how I have to do it. Right. And it's that learning through observation and understanding what the deer want, what you can give them to try to put things in your favor. So I think to me, that's the big thing, man. It's like, you just got to be in the timber.
It's not a lot different than the trapper then either. So the trapper may have been mentored by somebody that showed them everything, or they may not have. So if they learn on their own, they learn that, hey, this corner set up, you know, there's a bank, there's an undercut bank right there, and all those critters seem to roll along that undercut bank.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And every time I set my trap there, for some reason, I have something. Every 24-hour check, boom, there's something there. So eventually, if you're a good deer hunter or a good trapper, you start to learn, hey, what is it that makes this place that I catch this thing at every time so good?
Right.
And then you start eliminate it or figure out what it is. Oh, it's an undercut bank.
Right.
And the reason why it's undercut is because it's the outside corner of a creek. You know what I mean? Or whatever. You try to replicate that. And it's the same thing with deer hunting.
Yeah.
When you find a place that's good and you're having success when you're learning, you replicate it. And then next thing you know, it's almost like muscle memory.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost like muscle memory.
I love that you said that, because that's the one thing that I think, you know, and it's not, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. It's not getting married to a spot isn't what we're talking about here. Cause I'm totally picking up what you're putting down. It's once you've once you've learned how to have success, right? Or you've had some success, look back at those successful hunts and try to figure out, like, what was the common denominator between them? Right? What were those things that were done correctly, or what were those things that put things in my favor to have that encounter and ultimately to release that arrow, right? Because those weren't coincidences by most of the time, especially if you've done it over several times, right? If you've done it consistently over time, there are certain things that you're doing consistently, which is the reason why it's happening. And so all you try to do is to do those things consistently time over time, which is going to give you a better opportunity, like, or more opportunities, right? And the other thing you mentioned about the trapper, like that little bank where those critters want to roll or whatever, it's, to me, when things I think really started making more sense for me was when I was able to see something like that somewhere, like just say like around Philadelphia where I live, right? And then I would go to Missouri, or I'd go to Ohio, or I'd go to like wherever. And I could be in a completely different place with completely different habitat and terrain, and I could see something that would remind me of something I had seen in a completely different area, and be like, oh, this is how they're going to do that. Right. And so you start building like this catalog, and I've talked about this before, catalog of analogs, to where it's like, oh, the way this little kind of like high spot rolls here reminds me of this little high spot that I hunted in this swamp, but I'm in timber here. I bet they're going to use it similarly, or maybe the wind's going to do the same thing, you know? So you start to kind of create these analogs for yourself to where you can start to hunt new places, but have better hunts earlier in them, because you have like this Rolodex of different experiences that you can draw from and say, oh, this is going to hunt like this. And it doesn't have to be the same. Yep. It doesn't have to be the same habitat, same state, same anything. And that to me is like, that's when you start to level up a little bit, is like, okay, that place, that little cut in that bank, well, I don't need to see the same cut in that bank in the same state. I can go somewhere else, and it might not be a cut in a bank. It might be where a tree now is overhanging the water's edge that gives it a similar, I'm just making this up at this point.
But or whatever
like,
it is.
Yeah. Right, yeah, right. It is. That it's like, oh, they're going to use this the same way. You know what I mean? So it's creating those things.
It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing as when you're walking through the woods and you're going in a new piece, and you come up to an edge and you look over, there's an opening, and then you look 100 yards away and you see one tree over there, and you said, I guarantee that tree right there has got a scrape under it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen this 100 freaking times before, right?
Yeah.
I've seen this 100 times before, and okay, yep, there's a scrape right there, and oh, look at that little tag halter just another 50 yards past it over there. I guarantee there's three or four rubs right over there in that tag halter. You know what I mean? Right. And you walk over there, and it's boom, 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 exactly like you could see from before. You know, from 100 yards away, 150 yards away.
Yeah. And that's the type of stuff.
If you, when you start getting years of experience, and I've said this to other people before, and I think people roll their eyes and stuff like this, but I've killed many bucks by going in with a headlamp in the morning in a place I've never been before, Clint. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And just walking in with a headlamp at 5 o'clock in the morning, 2 hours before dark. And I can say, okay, look, there's an opening right here. There's an edge right here. And just look around because I've seen it. I've never been here before, but I've seen it 100 times.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Okay. If a deer's coming in here, okay, I know that's northwest over there. The wind's going to be coming this way. The deer's going to be coming along this edge. I don't want to walk in this opening. I want to cut into the woods a little bit. I'm going to go 30 yards into this thing. I'm going to cut over here. I want to get somewhere of the best tree along that edge. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And pick out a tree in the dark and kill a deer that morning.
Yeah.
It's happened to me many times, probably a dozen times.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, and that's where that experience comes in, where it's like you've seen these situations play out over and over and over again. Like I've not gotten to that point.
You have to be smart enough to know and see that and say, okay, that's where the deer's going to come. Not smart enough. Only that you've seen it before. You know, it's got to be pounded in. For me, I'm a real stupid guy, so it's got to be pounded in my. It's been pounded in my head 100 times.
Right.
Like, the deer's going to come this way, and if you walk right here where you think he's going to come, he's going to ground scent you, and you're never going to kill him. So you need to cut over downwind of it, cut down. You know, go 30 yards inside the wood line and walk down there, and then cut back over to the opening, find a tree along there. Guarantee that there's going to be a deer that comes along here. I guarantee it.
Right.
And boom. I mean, sometimes you get lucky and it's a 4-year-old. Sometimes it's a year and a half year old. You know what I mean? But it worked out exactly. You may not shoot the spike or the fork or the six, whatever it was, a year old. The 3-year-old you shoot. I do anyway. I hunt public land. You know what I mean?
Right.
But
the
sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. I think where some people make the mistake is when you were kind of talking about your entry net or what your access, right? I think that's the part. Like, I think some guys, especially if they've been hunting a while, like are able to look at a map, you know, whatever piece of land it is, and can kind of say, you know, based on what I know about the area or just in general, right? It's like, this is probably going to be a decent setup here, right? Whatever your criteria is, right? Whether you're trying to get away from people or whatever it is, right? You can kind of find certain things on a map, and you can kind of start to figure some stuff out. You know, and you will, you know, I think at least me, it's like, I'm usually somewhat in the ballpark, you know what I mean? It's and I think where a lot of folks will, you know, mess it up is that, you know, that's just half the battle. The other half of the battle is, are you willing to take the long route there and make sure your access is correct to not screw up where you think the deer are going to be coming from before you ever get there and kill your hunt before it ever happens? Right. That, because I think that's one of the hardest things whenever you're, you know, when you're walking into a place that's new. Cause, you know, I do a lot of, you know, I'll freestyle hunt. You know, I did all of Missouri this year, freestyle hunted that whole trip, you know, and, you know, and we were in,
good.
Yeah. We were in deer. Yeah. We were in deer within, you know, usually 2 days on each of the three pieces that we bounced to and stuff like that. And, you know, had some encounters and, you know, it was good. It was just, you know, we were just 20 yards away this time and 20 yards too far this time. It's just one of those, you know, luck of the draw type of things. But it was the same thing where it's like, we were scouting and saw like these scrapes that were in this area. And it was like, all right, this is where all the pressures come from. This is how people are entering this piece of property. This is the furthest place south of that. It would be the furthest hike. There's a couple scrapes here. I bet there's going to be bucks here in the morning. Right. Didn't feel like an evening spot. It was just a feeling, right? Like you look at it and how it was set up and it was like, I would never hunt this in the evening, but I would hunt it in the morning, you know? And sure enough, went back the next morning, set up on the ground and saw 2, maybe 3 bucks, you know? And it was just one of those things where it was like, I had seen that before and was like, and you could immediately kind of feel that, like, this is a morning spot, not an evening spot. You know, and I don't know why I thought that, but that was immediately what I thought. I was like, I'd never hunt this in the evening, but I'd only hunt it in the morning, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was just because I had seen that kind of set up before, you know, somewhere else, and just had a feeling that that's what would happen and kind of felt like the deer would come from this direction. And sure enough, there they were, you know? So it's, you know, it's just a matter of kind of, you know, spending enough time in the timber and seeing enough things, you can start to kind of play it out in your mind before it happens.
And you do. When you talk, and you've talked a lot of but very experienced hunters. But the one common denominator that people with real experience will tell you, you know, in the same class, those guys. But what you hear a lot of those guys say is, if your gut tells you to do something, and everything adds up into good, solid deer hunting, and your gut is telling you to do something, do it.
Yeah.
When you start building up your experience, and the gut is telling you to do something, go do it. You know what I mean? Jump on it right now. I mean, this might be your one day to hunt this week, but your gut is telling you to go do it. Go do it. You know.
Yeah.
I'm primarily a Saturday morning hunter. I mean, that's really what I have generally been able to, most of my hunting career is Saturday mornings. And I know a lot of guys, and I've been on the Hunting Beast, the Blood Brothers before that, and they're all evening guys and all that kind of stuff. And I love all the guys that have always been on those things, but I'm a morning guy.
So it's funny because you and Greg both are. And that's the thing, you know, and Cody DeQuisto is, right? Like, it's like, there's a handful of dudes I know who are morning guys, and like, I'm trying to be, you know, I'm not there yet. That's one of the things that I constantly is on my list every year of getting better is like hunting mornings, especially in like October. All right, folks, that is a wrap for today's show. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. And if you haven't yet, please head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating. And hell, while you're at it, head over to YouTube and give us a sub there too. I'd be super appreciative if you'd be able to do those two things for me. And before I shut this thing down, I need to give a big shout out to our partners who continue to help us make this podcast possible. Tethered, Exodus Outdoor Gear, Skull Brew Coffee Company, and Maven Optics. And until next time, we'll see y'all. All right, gang, the new Truth merch is in stock at truthfromthestand.com and on YouTube below any of the Truth from the Stand videos. I've got some new hats, beanies, t-shirts, long sleeve t-shirts, and sweatshirts. There's even a new do hard shit hat for those of us who like to embrace microdosing adversity. So head to truthfromthestand.com and check out the new gear and use the code TRUTH, TRUTH, and save yourself some cash on the new gear.